Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Edgar Allan Poe was one of the first to write detective fiction and is generally considered to be a pioneer in a number of genres in detective and mystery writing, crime writing, horror, even science fiction. So it is fitting that Lewis Bayard should feature Poe in his recently published thriller, The Pale Blue Eye. This is a story that is set at West Point at the Military Academy in the early years of the Point, during the time when Poe was a cadet there, not just in the story, but in fact, Poe was a cadet there. Someone is killing cadets at the Point and carving the hearts out of their bodies. So the authorities bring in a retired police detective, a man named Gus Landor, to investigate, and he selects Poe as his assistant. In this first episode, we'll be talking about the book, The Pale Blue Eye, which is published by HarperCollins. Talk a little bit about Poe and his significance in American literature and some of the challenges of using Poe as a character. And questions, of course, from people who are listening are welcome. Our guest is a writer and book reviewer. His work has appeared in The New York Times, The Washington Post, and other places. He was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico, grew up in Washington, D.C., got his bachelor's degree in English literature from Princeton and his master's in journalism from Northwestern. He's worked as a congressional press secretary, a communications director, and a speechwriter. And The Pale Blue Eye is his fourth novel. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Mr. Bayard, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I certainly enjoyed the book and also Mr. Timothy. And I think that my interest in Pale Blue Eye was on the strength of Mr. Timothy. Having read that, when I saw that you had something new out, I decided, well, I really wanted to read this book. And I have enjoyed both of them very much.
Well, good. I'm glad.
Your first two novels were set in the present, and then these two, the last two, are historical. Mr. Timothy is set in 1860, and Pale Blue Eye is set in 1830. So after having written about contemporary life, what was it that made you interested in going back to the 19th century to set now the following two books?
Well, I have to blame it initially on Charles Dickens. It seems safe to blame him because he's dead and he can't rise up and challenge me on this. Mr. Timothy was the story of the grown-up Tiny Tim from A Christmas Carol, and it really arose out of the fact that Charles Dickens was the writer that I've been reading longer than anybody, the writer who's nearer and dearer to my heart, and the writer who's been the greatest influence on my own work. So when I thought about literary work to reimagining a literary work or collaborating with a famous author, Dickens was the one who came to mind, and out of that impulse came Mr. Timothy. So I enjoyed the experience enough that I wanted to kind of duplicate it with the next book I did. And when I started thinking about other writers to collaborate I was surprised to find Edgar Allan Poe's name bounding back at me. Surprised, I suppose, because I hadn't read Edgar Allan Poe in something like 20 years. And if you'd asked me to list, you know, my favorite authors, my favorite works, I'm not sure Poe would have been on the list, only because I sort of ceased to give him much thought. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that he is part of our culture in a way that we often fail to recognize just because he's so deeply coded into it. And the more I gave it some cerebration, the more I realized it would be a highly appropriate thing for a writer of historical mysteries to salute the guy who, as you said, wrote the first mysteries in the English language.
Yeah. It's interesting, I think, what you've done with the two books. You've done something that, it's not that writers have not done this before, but I'm sure it's something that is potentially risky. On the one hand, taking as your main character a character from a very well-known story, the story that a lot of people will know, in the one case, and in the other, taking a real person out of history, a well-known writer who is, people may know things about him that aren't true, and then taking him as your character. As I say, and I think in both cases, some writers just wouldn't do it. They'd say, there are too many risks there, and I wouldn't do that.
I guess I didn't see the risk to it. To me, it was mostly promise. I was thrilled by the idea of trying to imagine my way into Edgar Allan Poe's head a little bit. And I think when you want to catch a novelist, you set a novelist to the task. I think we're the people best suited to trying to get into their heads, because we're the only ones messed up enough to understand all the unruliness that's inside there.
Maybe we'll return and talk a little bit about Mr. Timothy a little later on,
yeah.
But we should feature the Pale Blue Eye. The book, as I said, it's set at West Point and the Military Academy, and this was apparently at a point, as the characters in the story explain, when it was early in the history of the Point, there were people in Washington, including the president, Andrew Jackson, who didn't think much of the idea, and the future of West Point at that time was open to question. So that would be a reason enough for the people who were running West Point to want to avoid a scandal and something as serious as this, as a cadet or two turning up dead. That would have been very, very serious, and they would have wanted to clamp the lid on this as quick as they possibly could.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to imagine now because West Point is so ingrained in our institutional life. But yes, back then in 1830, it was only about, I want to say, 25 years old. And there was a great deal of opposition from Andrew Jackson, from people like Davy Crockett, who was then a congressman, to the idea, first of all, of a standing army. That was still a leftover hostility from the Revolutionary War days. And the idea of a military academy that was as tightly run as Sylvanus Thayer's military academy was. So he was considered something of a tyrant by a lot of the people who saw him at work. But now, of course, he's considered the father of West Point because he really put in place the system that is still pretty much intact today.
Edgar Allan Poe had this very difficult relationship, and he talks about it a lot in the book, talks about it with your other main character, a very difficult relationship with his foster family, particularly his foster father.
Mm-hmm.
As maybe people will know, remember if they know anything about Poe, his parents died, his father left when he was very young, and then his mother died. They were actors, and it seemed like he always felt this very strong connection, at least the literary Poe's, when we see him in novels, he always seems to feel this very strong attraction to the theater and, of course, to his mother.
Mm-hmm.
He was taken in by this other family, but always had a very difficult relationship with the man, Mr. Allen. That's where the Allen in his name comes from, Edgar Allan Poe.
Right.
And apparently it was this man who got him into West Point at a time when that might be sort of unlikely for someone of Poe's age. Can you talk a little bit about how it is that, and I know you have said one of the things that interests you is what Poe was doing there at all, because it was an engineering school, and it seemed to be an unlikely place for him to be. What do we know about why it is he was there at all?
As best we can make out, he was there to pacify John Allen, his foster father. He was trying to make good of himself, as so many young men have tried to do over the ages. And I think that's really the only reason that we can possibly divine. He had actually spent a little bit of time in the military. He was an enlisted soldier and served at Fort Moultrie and places like that. So he had some experience with the military, and in fact, he didn't do so badly under a military routine. And even in his first months at West Point, he seemed to actually thrive under a certain amount of discipline. It may be that was also an attraction, having, you know, a kind of imposed regiment on him, because he was a fairly wildly undisciplined person at other times in his life.
And he would have been older, quite a bit older than the other entering cadets. That would have been a problem for him. His personality might have been a problem for him, but one of the things that certainly would have been a problem for him was that the other cadets in his class would have been teenagers, and he was 20 or 21.
He was 20, which was a little old. He also happened to just look older than his age. So in fact, there was a scurrilous legend that went out about the cadets that he was actually the father of a cadet who had died before taking his place, and he was the father who had come to take his son's place at the Point. In fact, one of the nicknames he had there was Dad. I'm sure he didn't enjoy it very much at the time.
Well, there would have been a lot of reasons, no doubt, for him to be cast out or to be seen as someone apart. His age, his predilections for poetry, his tendency to embroider on his past and construct this sort of fantastic past for himself, this theatrical quality that he had, all of that would have made it very difficult for him, no doubt, to fit in.
Oh, I definitely think so. In fact, really, the attraction for me in writing about this particular stage in Poe's life was the misfit nature of it. What would it have been like to have Edgar Allan Poe in this kind of hyper-regimented, extremely masculine, very top-down environment, a guy who was really wanted nothing more in life than to be a poet and was at that time writing this very expansive, Miltonic, blank verse. I just was really intrigued by the way those two sensibilities chafed against each other, and so it was fun to imagine Poe in that world.
Yeah, and it's the kind of world that you see often in mysteries that is a very closed society. Mm-hmm. It is a tight-knit community. It's sort of my understanding that, in fact, that for most of the time when cadets were there, they never left. They weren't allowed to leave, and it was maybe either unintentionally or intentionally, kind of like a monastery. I don't know if it was in something that I read that you made that comparison, or it was in one of the reviews, that it was this very tightly restricted, tightly closed, all-male world.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And you're right that during their 4 years there, a cadet could leave the reservation exactly once. I think it was the summer before their last year they could leave. And it was a particularly remote area in that day. There were no trains, of course, and the only way you could really get there was by steamer, and there were some very poor roads along that. And so they were really in the middle of nowhere, and it was monastic, and it was very male. The only women were either faculty wives or faculty daughters. There were also women who would sometimes come up from New York. What West Point was at the same time a very popular tourist designation, part of the Hudson River line, basically. So there were various flirtations along with the appropriately named flirtation walk. But yes, they were not even allowed to have girlfriends or wives of any kind.
Yeah, that you'd have to feel sorry for the poor faculty daughters, because they would be really be the only women around who would be eligible and respectable enough so that a cadet might make them the target of their affections. And I'm sure there were many, many more cadets than there were faculty daughters.
Oh, I would say so. It would depend on the daughter. I mean, maybe some of them would have liked that ratio. I probably would. Others might find it a little oppressive to have all these young men. But it definitely made for tensions. Anytime you restrict young men of hormonal stage of development, you're asking for some degree of trouble.
Our guest in this hour, Lewis Byard. His new novel is The Pale Blue Eye. It is published by HarperCollins. It is a mystery story that takes place at West Point in 1830 and involves an investigation of a series of murders. One of the characters in the book is Edgar Allan Poe, who was indeed at that time a cadet at the Academy when he was 20. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I know this is a terrible, terrible cliche to say, but I guess I will say that in this book, West Point is a character, very, very much so. You must have spent it, certainly, and the way you describe it certainly makes it sound as if you must have spent a lot of time researching what life would have been like and simply going there and soaking up the atmosphere.
I did go there, and I have to say, it is the most beautiful campus I have ever been to. And I've been to, as you mentioned, I went to Northwestern, which is beautiful. I've been to Princeton, UVA. I've visited lots of places. And I don't think anything tops West Point for sheer natural beauty. The mountains rising on either side and the river curving around. It's just a stunning location. That said, I only spent a couple of days at West Point, because the West Point of today is obviously rather different from the one of 1830, and that was reconstructed mostly through books, and that was in fact my biggest research challenge, figuring out what exactly life would be like at that early stage in West Point's development.
Hmm. Well, what, can you talk a little bit about that? What would it have been like if we could have gone there?
It would have been largely woods. There would have been a few small buildings, some guard posts, but it would have been very Spartan. you wouldn't have had any sort of playing fields, any kind of anything in the way of organized athletic activity. The plain, which is the main marching parade grounds, was in place. That's still in place today. That's maybe the most famous piece of terrain there. But it looked very different then because they were dragging cannons and marching horses along it. It was very cut up and patchy and divided. So it was a much more primitive way of life there. And of course, all the sort of modern amenities weren't there. And it was a much smaller, of course, campus at the time. So it would really be hard to recognize most of it.
Yes, you mentioned there was some controversy surrounding West Point because in Washington there were people who didn't like this idea of making officers that way. They thought that officers should come up from within the ranks.
Through the ranks, yeah.
And that was the way to learn how to be a soldier by being a soldier and starting at the very bottom and working your way up. And there were a lot of people, as we say, among them, Thomas Jefferson and Davy Crockett, who thought that this was an elitist institution. Mm-hmm. They didn't like the idea at all. So who would have been a cadet there at the time? What would these people have been like? And would they have been sons of people who had influence, or would it be a more kind of average cross-section of America?
Well, Sylvanus Thayer liked to say it was a cross-section. The one trick you have to be, and I think it's still true today, you had to be appointed. There were two appointments per state, I believe. So you did have to attract the eye of somebody in power. Obviously, being wealthy and well-positioned in society was a good way to do that. But there were plenty of farmer's sons there. In fact, at some point in the book, Sylvanus Thayer makes a point of saying that the class leadership post, the leader of the first class, is not Henry Clay Jr., the son of the famous congressman, but a farmer's son. So they definitely like to think of themselves as a mirror of America's democracy. And in fact, they did get a fairly impressive cross section. Obviously, they were white, young white men, but even their educational levels varied radically. Stonewall Jackson, when he went to West Point, and I think he went there in the 1830s. Well before he was known as Stonewall, could barely do math on a blackboard. He was extremely ill-educated and just barely managed to pass the qualifying exam to get in. So, and yet he wound up being one of the great generals in American history. Hmm.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone who's listening up in Aurora in the northern part of the state. Well, you know where Aurora is.
Yes.
on our line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
I suppose you can tell by my accent that I'm from the East Coast. I just wanted to say that in the Bronx, on Fordham Road, there is, as far as I know, Edgar Allan Poe's home is still there. It's a very tiny house and surrounded by a small piece of grass, you know, not much of a lawn. And I just thought anybody that would be going there might want to look it up, see if it's still available. It's very interesting to see with all the other tall, modern buildings around it. Thank you.
Yes, you're right. That is one of that is still open to the public, I believe. And it is a little bit removed from Manhattan, but you're in the Bronx. But Poe, one of the interesting things about him, one of the challenging things, is that he really got around over the course of his relatively short life. He was born in Boston, grew up in Richmond, lived variously in Philadelphia and New York and Baltimore, and so he left kind of traces behind in a lot of different places. There's a Poe Museum in Richmond and another in he's buried, of course, in Baltimore. So he covered the Eastern Seaboard.
And I think the people in Baltimore like to claim him, even though he really didn't spend all that. That's where he died, but he really didn't spend all that much of his life in Baltimore.
He spent some time there. And, of course, most of his family was there, so there was that kind of emotional attachment. But, yeah, he spent most of his adult life, I would think, in New York. I haven't actually parceled out the years.
The people may be familiar with Poe's writing. I know you spent a lot of time reading that and on writers that were contemporaries of Poe's to get a sense of the language for the time. And a lot, I'm sure, has been written about Poe. Some of it maybe open to question about whether it's accurate or not. Certainly, mm-hmm. a lot of the things that were written immediately after his death may indeed not have been true. How did you go about trying to get a feeling for Poe as a living person and then try to make a living, breathing character out of him?
That's a really good question. The first thing I did was just try to get an objective fix on his life, and you're right, that is very difficult to do. His first biographer, the one who wrote the first biography of him, was actually one of his most implacable enemies. So, you know, never have your own history written by your enemies. And it's taken biographers a long time to sort out the facts from the various legends and myths that have inevitably sprung up around him. But in my mind, the most judicious biography of him is by Lawrence Silverman. It's called Mournful and Never-Ending Remembrance. So I definitely paid very close attention to that and to Silverman's various psychological speculations. But a lot of my imagining of Poe came from reading and rereading the work. That was really the most invaluable thing for me to do. And in some instances, I actually listened to recordings of it that were made by people like Basil Rathbone and Vincent Price to get that gothic cadence in my head. And it was just a full-body immersion in Poe. And one of the things I was really surprised to learn is how creepy his stuff still is to this day. There are stories that still really get under your skin. Poe had a very strong sense of the dark things and the unspeakable things that go on inside our heads.
Yeah, and while it's true that even during his lifetime and after, some people really gravitated toward those stories, that Poe was, I guess, somewhat controversial because there were other people who thought their stories were just, they were too warped, they were too dark, they were the kinds of things that people just shouldn't be thinking about, shouldn't be writing about, and shouldn't be reading.
Yeah, I think they were always very controversial. Although during his life, I would say he was probably, the stories were the least notable part of what people thought about Edgar Allan Poe. When they thought about him, they thought of, first of all, as the author of The Raven, which was a huge success in its day. And second of all, probably as a critic, he was a rather ferocious reviewer who carried on various literary wars with figures like Longfellow and Hawthorne. And probably if you'd asked people to name what Edgar Allan Poe did, his stories would have numbered far down on the list. It was the efforts of Charles Baudelaire, his French translator, who really rescued Poe's stories, his horror stories, from oblivion. But it's interesting what you say about those stories being too dark. When I first contemplated writing this book, I wasn't sure that I was dark enough to enter into Edgar Allan Poe's mind, because his stuff really is so strange, and you keep thinking, what kind of crazy guy would write this? So I had to look at my own work and realize that, in fact, I was already mining those words, that vein of horror. There's a scene in Mr. Timothy, for instance, where I trapped the hero in a burning coffin. It's a very intense, very gothic moment. I wasn't thinking of Poe when I did it, but when I looked at it again, it was very clear to me that I was already channeling Poe in some unspoken way. So it seemed like an easy step to make him the central figure in a book.
You talked a little earlier about how you thought in your writing Charles Dickens was an important influence, and mm-hmm. that, in fact, there would have been a point if somebody asked you, had Poe been a particularly favorite writer of yours, you would have said, well, not really, that the important writer would have been Dickens. In what ways do you think Dickens has influenced your writing?
What I love about Dickens is the energy and the vividness of his writing. The critical establishment will take him to task because his characters are considered flat as opposed to round. They're defined by one or two traits. But I think Ian Forster said that they're so vivid that they seem to vibrate into something like roundness. You just feel life pouring out of the page. And that's really been my goal as a writer, is to make every story I do as vivid as it can be, to make the people, you know, pop off the page as much as they can, because that to me is the excitement of reading. That's why people read in the first place, is not just to get life, you know, copied back to them, but heightened and made memorable and rich. And there's just, Dickens is just, he's so rich in his range, in his characterization, in his passion, and his anger. It's just, I I enjoy reading him enormously.
Yeah. Our guest this morning, Lewis Byard, is a novelist, also a book reviewer. His work has appeared in a number of places, including New York Times and Washington Post. He has spent some of his life in Washington, D.C., where he worked as a congressional press secretary, as a communications director, and a speech writer. He's also a graduate of Northwestern University, got a master's degree in journalism from Northwestern. He's authored 4 novels. The most recent is The Pale Blue Eye. That's the book mostly we've been talking about here. It's published by HarperCollins and is out now in the bookstore if you want to read it. Also, you might like his previous book, Mr. Timothy, which is now available in paperback. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Timothy is Timothy Cratchit, a.k.a. Tiny Tim. And what you've done, I think, is an interesting thing here with this book, is you've taken this story that most everyone will know and taken this character who is important in the story in Christmas Carol, although maybe not very fully realized, but he's an important character, and essentially said at the end of the story, said, let's make these real people and then ask what happened the next day and then and the day after that. It's sort of like, you know, let's take this out and take it and make this world real, make it really gritty, and then ask, so what happens next?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's a natural impulse for all of us. If we've enjoyed a book a lot, if we've really entered into a fictional universe and gotten to know these characters, I think it's natural for us to want to know what happens after the end of this. You know, what happens to Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy at the end of Pride and Prejudice? Do they have a wonderful marriage, or are they still fighting, you know, 30, 40 years later? So, it's to me, it comes out of a reader's impulse to want to know more about a particular character. In the case of Tiny Tim, the impulse was a little bit different because I never particularly cared for Tiny Tim. It's always the confession I have to make to people, is that he always annoyed me as a child. When I even as a child, he just seemed like one of those perfect children that your mother compared you to, and you could never be as perfect as that. And I never believed that somebody with his disabilities and in his impoverished station would be as sweet and true and pure as that. So the book Mr. Timothy came out of my desire to create an alternative story about Tiny Tim, to find the Tim Cratchit that Dickens didn't tell us about. And to that end, I made him an adult, and I took away the crutch, left him with just a slight limp, and dropped him into this rather unsavory Victorian milieu in which he's living in a brothel and teaching the madam of the brothel how to read and write in exchange for room and board, and at night going out with his friend Captain Gully to dredge the River Thames for dead bodies. So right away, you know, this is not your grandmother's Tiny Tim. And but in the end, it's still what I consider a Christmas story. It takes place at Christmas, and the grown-up Tim Cratchit undergoes an arc of redemption very similar to the one that Ebenezer Scrooge underwent.
Mm. Well, I thought it was very entertaining, and I think actually I did. If I think back, I think I did read it myself around Christmas time, so it seemed, or maybe it was in the winter, so it seemed like it was particularly appropriate because there were so many references in the book to the fact that it was this very gray, gritty kind of winter that you think of in Dickens and books of that time. So it seemed the perfect time to be reading that, not in July, but in January probably is the time to read that book. And I wonder, though, when you how it came into print, and if you said to people, look, I got this book, see, it's a gothic thriller, and the hero is Tiny Tim, and he's all grown up, and he's teaching the madam of the whorehouse to read, and you know, as you just described it, and did people say to you, are you nuts? Are you crazy? You can't be serious about this now.
Yeah. Yes, more than one person said that, including a rather well-known mystery writer who I mentioned the idea to. I really wrote the book entirely on spec. I didn't have a contract. I didn't even have an agent when I started it. But once I did have an agent, he duly shopped it around to various houses, and people were really nervous about it. They felt that I'd done something very dangerous with this rather iconic and obviously in many cases beloved figure, and they worried that people wouldn't want to see their darling Tiny Tim besmirched or smeared or maligned. So So it did. There was a certain amount of resistance to it. And in fact, there was only one editor who bit out of many who actually saw the manuscript. The good news, at least from my point of view, is that after the book came out, at least two or three different editors who passed on it before sent notes to me or my agent recanting their original decision and regretting it. But I can understand. It's a strange idea at first.
Yeah. The other thing I think that's I'd mentioned that I think it starts from this interesting place that says, let's take this character from this well-known story, make it real in a gritty sort of way, and then say, all right, now what happens, which mm-hmm. it does then. But it also, I think it puts you into thinking about, put yourself in that situation where we have this this family that's just hanging on, sort of impoverished, working for this horrible, the dad works for this horrible man, and they're just trying to make their way in life, and they have this little boy that's got some serious health problems, and so forth and so on. So the way that it works out is here, Uncle Ebenezer becomes the benefactor of the family, and he says, I'll make sure that I'll take care of this family, and no one will want ever again. Well, it does also make you think about what would happen if somebody comes along and says to you, well, I'm going to solve all your problems. You don't have anything ever to worry about again. You know, I will make the road smooth before you. And one of the things that Tim in the story does is he seems to be the one Cratchit who balks, who's not really sure how he feels about that idea of, even though Uncle Ebenezer is a fine, you know, he turns out to be the guy in the story. Yes, he turned this life around. He really is a decent sort of a fellow. He is trying to do the right thing. But Tim is not so sure how he feels about having his future handed to him on a silver plate.
You're right. In my mind, one of the things that Mr. Timothy is an exploration of the limits of philanthropy. You know, Scrooge steps in to this family's life and pours all this money on them and hopes that will make things go away and make everything better, as you said, make the smooth road. And it doesn't work that way, in part because circumstances don't allow it. People get ill. Victorian England was a tough world to survive in, no matter how much money you had. And when the book begins, actually, the Cratchit family is seriously depleted. Both parents are dead, and Tim is rather estranged from this generous Uncle Scrooge of his. And I think it's that feeling, what I imagine to be when you're dependent on someone, that inevitably you come to resent them. You resent your dependency. You resent the fact that you can't be a freestanding individual. And you resent what they come to represent. So it's a kind of a counterintuitive, but to me, a very plausible reaction to being on Scrooge's payroll.
Well, that book is Mr. Timothy. It is available in paperback. The new book is The Pale Blue Eye. It is out still in hardcovers, published by HarperCollins. If you want to read books, you can look for them in the bookstore or the library, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'll haul us back here to Poe and Pale Blue Eye. There are these two central characters here, Poe and Gus Landor, who's this retired New York police detective who happens to be living nearby West Point, and he is recruited by the commanders at the point to investigate these murders, and then he decides he's got to have somebody on the inside, and he picks Poe. So that's how Poe comes into the story. And the thing that both of these men seem to have in common is loss. Poe still is mourning the loss of his real mother and his foster mother. And of course, later on in life, he would lose this teenage girl that he marries. Gus Landor is mourning, still perhaps mourning the loss of his wife and also his daughter. And interestingly enough, going back to Mr. Timothy, one of the things that Mr. Timothy is dealing with in the story as it opens is the death of his father, Bob, the Bob Cratchit, who has died. And he's feeling now really adrift and orphaned in the world. Is there something about loss of parents that particularly grabs you?
I suppose so, partly because my parents are still alive, but my father is certainly in decline. He's in assisted living right now and has senile dementia. At the same time, I have two very young boys, adopted boys, and I'm getting kind of the both ends of the father-son equation in rather powerful ways at the time being, and definitely aware of the holes that are left in our psyches, in our hearts, by the people who leave us. That said, I have to say part of it too stems from the fact that this is the 19th century, and that is that I think we talked about life expectancies were rather short. People were in the midst of life. People were in death. The amount of child mortality was extremely high. I think the average lifespan was maybe 38, 40. It was very low. So people tend to have had to confront grief from many different fronts all the time. And then you look at Poe's own work, and Poe himself is obsessed with death. There's one story called The Premature Burial of a man who's convinced that he's been locked in a coffin, buried in a coffin. As it turns out, he's just in a very dark bunk on a ship. He's forgotten where he was. But Poe is particularly obsessed with death. And in fact, there was a general terror about premature burial in those days because there were, I guess, a couple of famous incidents of people being buried alive. So death is, you know, very much a part of the culture. In a way, I don't think it is anymore. I think medicine extending the life expectancy and Americans today live as though death isn't there, whereas I think it was constantly on people's minds in the 19th century.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned that, I do seem to recall something about, perhaps it was about this time that there was someone who was trying to market coffins that had some sort of emergency device in there so that if you were buried alive,
yes,
there was some way that you could signal the fact that you were in the coffin and that you were actually alive.
Well, there were bells, I believe, and it's my understanding, this could be an urban legend, but it's my understanding that the expression "saved by the bell" actually comes from these devices that people, you know, who, you know, if they woke up from whatever coma they were in and found themselves in a coffin, they could just ring away and get rescued. I don't know if they actually worked or not, but
I think you and I both have been reading some strange things. I don't know where,
I think so too.
Where we're getting this. Let's go. We'll talk with someone else here. Savoy, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I don't have a lot of time, and I came in just on part of this conversation, so my comments are going to be strictly related to the portion of the radio discussion. I have not read the Mr. Timothy and probably never will, but I wish to raise an alternative way to think here. I think this raising of objection to the author's use of these historical, quote-unquote, figures. I think psychiatrically it's not well thought out, at least for this radio discussion. The system of growth and development is such that as Tiny Tim and the others were to grow, and as Mr. Dickens set the wheels in motion, evil or disreputable, dastardly things would just not be in the cards. Something incredible would have to have happened, such as a marriage to someone who distorted the poor fellow's thinking, or today it would be getting on drugs, of course. But so far, based on what I've heard on the radio, I don't think the author's logic holds well, and I have to go. Sorry.
Well, okay. There's one critic heard from.
Oh, there's a million critics everywhere.
That's well. I suppose that's well. I guess the question is, what do you think about that? And maybe if you take a character from Dickens, do you feel that? What do you feel that you owe to Dickens or to that character or do you feel that there's no reason for you to feel constrained by the constraints of that Dickens himself would have imposed on the story?
That's a really good question. I do think there is a kind of ethical obligation. You know, as an author, I would be appalled if someone took a character of mine and did something completely out of character with it. But at the same time, I won't be able to imagine what the mores of 100 years from now will be. So I felt perfectly free to reinterpret this character of Tim Cratchit according to our modern understanding, A, of children. You know, the Victorians were notoriously sentimental about children, and children were considered these very pure beings. So Tiny Tim didn't strike them as quite the anomaly that he appears today. And second of all, to be a little more honest about the things that were going on in Victorian society at the time, things that Dickens would have talked about if he could. He would have, I'm sure, talked more about prostitution, because that was rampant in London at that time. He would have been very honest about the sexual predation on young girls, particularly foreign young girls, because he was passionately concerned with the suffering of children. And I sort of feel, in a way, I'm doing the things that he, as I said, would have done if he could have done, if the mores at the time had allowed it.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 5-8, again with novelist Lewis Byard. His new novel is The Pale Blue Eye. It is a thriller that's set in 1830 at West Point, where there are a series of murders investigated by a police detective, a retired police detective, with the help of young Edgar Allan Poe, who was at that time, and actually was at that time, a cadet at West Point. And then also the book before that was the one we've talked about as well, Mr. Timothy, which is about the grown-up Tiny Tim. That book is set in 1860, and both of them are thrillers of a fashion, gothic thrillers, I guess. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Do you think that as a result of reading Poe, closely reading Poe and trying to get a sense of who he was, and also reading about what has been written about him, biographies and commentaries and such, that there was something that you learned about Poe that you think either you didn't know before or that that people wouldn't recognize immediately?
That's a really good question. One of the things that I was struck by was how much he was, first of all, how much he was able to produce. He died, I think, at the age of 41. And left behind a very considerable body of work, and it's a fully realized body of work. I think Marshall McLuhan said he left no unfinished thoughts. It's very much of a piece, all his poems, his prose. And so that's impressive to me. But I think what most impresses me about him, having lived with him for as long as I have, is how brave he is. I say that because you read his stories, and we talked about how weird they are and how bizarre and disturbing they are. And you get the sense that he puts all of his unconscious and subconscious out there and doesn't censor himself and doesn't stop to worry about whether people think he's crazy. He gets it out there. And I don't know if it was particularly therapeutic for him, but when you live by that, when you see that example, it can't help but be inspiring to you as a writer to get in touch with your own darkness, because Poe knew as well as anybody. According to what one of the characters in The Pale Blue Eye says, there's a bit of rot in all of us. And Poe was fully aware of that and fully prepared to follow the implications of that all the way to the end. And so his stories are peopled with maniacs, with people who, you know, start out as normal, law-abiding people and take a wrong turn and end up doing unimaginable things. And he was clear-eyed and tough enough to see the possibilities for darkness and for light that lie within all of us.
Many writers who came after Poe admired his work. Others were critics. There were some of each, of well-known writers that either thought that Poe was great and they owed him a debt, and others who didn't like his work and didn't like him. One of those who certainly acknowledged the debt was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the man who created Sherlock Holmes, because Poe is generally regarded as being one of, if not the father, one of the fathers of the detective story, and particularly with the three stories that he wrote about the French detective Dupin that you see in Murders in the Rue Morgue. That was the one.
The first one.
And in this book here, Your Detective, Gus Landor does a little Sherlockian turn, which I really liked. I thought it was certainly was a nod at that sort of that character, where near the beginning, someone, a young man, is summoned from the point to get him and doesn't want to tell him why they want him to. They send a carriage and they say, look, they want you to come to West Point. And your character, Gus Landor, can't get this young man to tell him much of anything. So at one point they're riding together, and he does one of these things where, just simply based on observing the young man, he tells him several things about himself. And of course, when Holmes or any other detective does that, the person is always taken aback, and they think, well, how is it that you can tell that? And there's something tremendously appealing about that. And maybe that's why we love Sherlock Holmes, or where we love other detectives,
right?
Because they can do things like that.
They can just they can, yeah, and make intuitions and inferences at some kind of lightning speed, and they can figure out things that the rest of us are still in the dark about. It's interesting you bring up the Sherlock Holmes example, because in my mind, Sherlock Holmes was at least in part inspired by Poe's character of Dupin. They have a lot of fairly obvious similarities. And in fact, Doyle once said that Sherlock Holmes was not as brilliant a detective as C. Auguste Dupin, the character that Poe introduced in The Murders in the Rue Morgue and stories like The Purloined Letter. It's really interesting to me, Poe, one of the things that Poe figured out was that the solving of a crime could be as interesting, as compelling, as suspenseful as the crime itself. I think that was a really novel insight that he made, and people, because if you read the stories, they're actually rather static. Dupin almost never leaves his room. He just spends his time there trying to, you know, sifting through the facts and coming up with unassailable conclusions. And it was to Poe's credit that he realized just the simple act of cerebration of a brilliant mind applying itself to a problem could be compelling in itself.
And yet the character, your detective in the book, is really not he's really not like that. He seems to be much more in a contemporary mold, maybe of a contemporary police detective, because
yeah.
It seems that so much of the time it seems like he's kind of stumbling around in the dark, which I suppose everybody in the story really is.
That's right. Well, his name is Gus Landor, and that name actually, the Gus is a salute to Auguste Dupin, but he's definitely a rather different sort of character. He's a folksier and less educated. He's a retired New York City constable, and he's really there to provide a counterweight to Poe, and also a kind of mirror, so we can see Poe in a way more clearly, seeing him refracted through somebody else's eyes. And over the course of this book, they develop a very intense and familial bond in the course of solving this crime, and become kind of father and son to each that they've never had before. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, that's the real emotional through line of the story, is this growing and deepening bond between them.
And there's an interesting the story takes some interesting and unexpected twists, which we will not reveal here.
Good for you.
But I guess I will say what I think is interesting is that there's almost a bit of a reversal in the relationship, at least in the sense that early on, Landor thinks he knows everything about Poe, thinks he's sort of has in a sense in their relationship, has the dominant role, thinks he's got him all figured out. And yet Landor has some important secrets, too, that eventually by the end, Poe figures out. So in a sense, they both have seen something in the other, have recognized something important, have seen things that perhaps the other would just as soon keep
right
hidden.
Right. They wind up applying their own detective abilities on each other, and to somewhat cathartic effect. It's interesting because in my mind. Yeah, Landor's secrets sort of stay hidden, and Poe's secrets also sort of stay hidden, and they eventually come to light, and with various degrees of relevance to the mystery. But Poe himself was a mythomaniac, is a nice word for it, a liar, you might also call it. He was well known for embroidering on his past and inventing things to make himself look better or his own past look better. He pretended that his parents had died in a theater fire in Richmond, when in fact his father had run away. He was an alcoholic and was never seen again. His mother died of some sort of unexplained disease. And of course, actors themselves were considered very low class in those days. So yeah, they're all carrying, both Landor and Poe are carrying around these various ghosts and these secrets. And what would a mystery be without them?
Yeah, they both, in a way, I was struck by, I was talking about the fact that Poe had, among the writers who came after, he had admirers and he had critics, and I was really struck by T.S. Eliot, who apparently said that Poe had the intellect of a highly gifted person before puberty. which you can see that in this character, that he had a sort of precociousness. He was gifted, he was brilliant, but also was
arrested,
not... Yes, exactly.
I think that's true. I wouldn't disagree with that. There is something deeply arrested in Poe's, about Poe's emotional viewpoints, at least as they're portrayed in his stories. I mean, women, for instance, are never flesh, what I would consider flesh and blood women. They're these sort of doomed, pale maidens who often just waste away. And they're either complete victims or complete sort of death, forces of death. And you know, when you learn that his marriage was probably not consummated, at least for the first few years, he married his cousin when she was 13. So clearly, this is a man who has a hard time dealing with the concept of a real woman, who has to kind of idealize or distance himself in some way from them. So, lots of issues to spend a lot of time on a couch if you're
to say the least. Exactly. So, well, we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish. Can you talk about, or would you be interested in talking about what you might be working on at the moment?
Oh, sure. I'm working on a book set in, I'm moving backward by two decades, so each stretch. This is 1818 Paris, and it involves a real-life detective named Eugène François Vidocq, who was the first real private detective, but before that he was a convict who became a policeman, and in fact the top policeman in all of Paris. He was the inspiration for Jean Valjean and Javert both in Les Misérables, and he was a fascinating figure. So he's kind of my new avatar. I'm going to be exploring some of the craziness of French politics and Parisian life right after Napoleon's abdication.
Well, that sounds good. Well, I appreciate very much you taking some time to talk with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been fun.
The two books, if you'd like to read them, the brand new one is The Pale Blue Eye. It's published by HarperCollins, and the one before that, Mr. Timothy, by our guest, Lewis Byard.